Oh, crap.
The moment when it hits the fan. I'm Meredith Hartley.
I'm Frank Hutchison.
And you're listening to Oh Crap, the Crisis Management Podcast, helping you survive your Oh Crap moments in business and in life. Brought to you by Me Squared. You can learn more at our website, www.me2-solutions.com. That's www.me2-solutions.com. Okay, you were just talking about Volkswagen.
Yes, well, like Volkswagen. And what they did is they basically had the computer that's on board could sense when a emissions test was being conducted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the question is, how many people had to know that that was being done? Well, obviously, there is the person who programmed it. There's people who review the programming. So there's the programming team, basically.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a testing team, because you have a team to test separate from the programming team. Then you might have someone on the engineering team, but not the whole engineering team needs to know about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's whoever is responsible for that portion of it. Then you have maybe someone in management. But even then, that's not really necessary, because that can all be done down in such a low level that no one knows about it. It's the same problem you had with the Challenger when it blew up in
the
sky.
Which you were on the review committee for that.
No, I was on the Columbia.
That was the Columbia. Okay, sorry. You were on the Columbia.
But on the Challenger, what happened is that the engineers knew that the O-rings became brittle at low temperatures.
Right.
Word never got up to senior management, who could say yay or nay. The people who were told about it eventually kind of put it on the list and finally just dropped off.
Mm-hmm.
So it never got passed up. So in the case of where the CEO of Volkswagen, you know, resigns because he accepts the responsibility, well, yes, but no. He's responsible for the overall culture of the company.
Mm-hmm.
But is he responsible for telling people to do that? Probably not.
Well, it's a cover-up. I mean, you can throw out the CEO. Fine. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But it's a Band-Aid. It's not actually fixing the problem. You have to actually go into the system and figure out where it came from, why it happened, and then you go back to the CEO at the time, whatever it was, and figure out what do we do that instituted a culture that made this possible.
That's right. I faced the same situation on a personal level when I was at Newport News Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company on the supervisor of shipbuilding.
Yeah.
What we discovered was that the engineers and the machinists that were in a remote location were basically talking to each other and solving problems that they faced in building and repairing what's called subsafe valves. These are valves which are critical to the safety of seawater systems in submarines.
Okay.
And any changes to the design or the manufacturer have to be approved by NAVSEA.
Which is?
The Naval Sea System Command.
Yes.
And so what you had, though, was during lunch, a machinist would be talking to his buddy or an engineer and saying, oh, I got this problem with this valve, this is what it is. And the engineer would say, oh, here's what you do. He'd draw something on the back of a napkin or whatnot and give it to the machinist and he'd go back to his desk. Oh, okay, so that's how I fixed the problem. But they're never approved. No one else knew about it because it's being done at that level. When it finally was discovered, we had about 10 years of work we had to go back and examine. And it was a mess. But what was really interesting was that only ones who were currently in positions in the process at the time that it was discovered were the ones that were affected.
Mm-hmm.
The people who had been in those positions, my predecessors and so
on. They didn't go back, find them, hunt them down, discuss it with them, investigate it.
It was, this is your problem, you're responsible, why didn't you do something about it?
Wow.
But no one knew about it because the people at the lower levels were doing it. And everything was working.
Mm-hmm.
They were passing inspections and doing all these things, and everybody was happy until someone saw a little piece of paper on a workbench.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what caused the problem to come to light.
But so that's a bias we have to watch for as business owners, as problem solvers in general in the world.
Yes.
Is that just because we found the problem now, it doesn't, and just because we fire the people in charge, whatever else. I mean, yeah, that's, you see that oftentimes. I mean, we do crisis management. That clean break can be very, very important in regaining public trust.
Yes.
But it's also horrible in maintaining internal trust.
More than that, because it means that people don't learn. The organization doesn't learn.
Mm-hmm.
The message comes, don't get caught.
Yes.
Just the other day, I was reading in the paper that one of the problems we have in medicine is that sometimes you have to go to two or three or four specialists before you find out what the real problem is.
Oh, gosh, yeah, that's happened with my family over and over again.
But the thing is that whoever finds the real problem, they never go back to the other physicians you saw and said, hey, guys, you missed this.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't learn.
Yep.
They think they did their job.
Yep.
They did it well.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. They made a mistake.
Yep.
No one goes back and teaches the system how it made a mistake so it could be fixed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, we saw that definitely with both of, I mean, when my daughter was being diagnosed with her food allergies and myself being diagnosed with my hormone disorder, is there was a doctor who had a very specific bias. He said, well, you know, people with this particular hormone disorder, PCOS, they can't get pregnant. It's the number one cause of fertility or infertility issues. And yes, it is that, but just because it's the number one cause of infertility issues doesn't mean that women who have it can't get pregnant. Lots of women get pregnant with it. And then symptoms can get worse after you've had a child. And, I mean, there are a lot of other things there. And so I saw multiple doctors who told me that I couldn't possibly have this because I just had two children. I never had trouble getting pregnant. Until finally a doctor actually sat down and did the tests, a new doctor, and he said, yeah, you fit the criteria. And plus, that criteria was updated a few years ago. They were functioning with bad information. And the same thing with my daughter, who had a very, very rare and severe childhood allergy called food protein-induced enterocolitis. It's an atypical allergy, but it is a food allergy. It doesn't have the traditional throat closing. A child eats the food, and the food proteins hit their intestines, where a reaction occurs with the cells in their intestine that causes horrific vomiting and diarrhea, dangerously low blood pressure, shock. Mm-hmm. And I saw multiple doctors who said it didn't exist because they couldn't test for it a specific way. It didn't show up on blood tests. Mm-hmm. And so it was finally, when we moved here to Spokane, I met our doctor here, Dr. Solomon, who was absolutely brilliant, amazing, wonderful pediatric immunologist. He sat there going, of course it's an allergy. Who told you that? Why? I can't believe a doctor would say this wasn't a real thing. It was on my board exams.
But he didn't go back and tell the doctor.
Because he couldn't. Because we don't have a system that always allows that.
That's
and
right.
So we've built these silos that prevent it from happening. To the point that even just, I mean, she was diagnosed, gosh, she was two, so that's been
five years
when we saw him. But just the other day, I had to comment. Actually, it was two nights ago. I commented on a post by an allergy foundation. They posted an article by a pediatric immunologist who made a claim about children with FPIES, that FPIES isn't reported in children who were breastfed. And the whole stream of answers, there were comments, hundreds of comments from people saying, yes, it is. My child was exclusively breastfed. Mine was. My daughter had symptoms of it in the NICU on just breast milk. But right there, you had immediate feedback to this foundation. They'd also said some other horrible things. And I watched in real time as the article kept getting updated and updated and updated. And I think it's one of the benefits we have now with the internet is that you can, if it's made public like that, you can force people to correct very, very quickly. But we don't, and that's a benefit, I mean, for all of us. It was a good thing for the foundation to be able to correct that. Their sponsor, which is a major formula company that produces a medical formula for children with this issue, they needed to know that, so it would be correct. The author needed to correct that. But we don't create that culture in our businesses.
And it's really not our culture, even in our culture, if
you
will.
No, not particularly.
Very rarely do we go back and tell people how they made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And
or admit when we realize that we've made mistakes. We don't go back and correct things. I mean, we post a meme that was wrong on Facebook, and someone says, oh, yeah, this was, you know, proven by Snopes, it's not right. And we just delete it, or we move on, or we ignore it. But that's been going on for millennia.
Yes, it has. And it's not going to stop. It's basic human nature.
Well, it's not going to stop necessarily on a large scale, but knowing it happens means that we can each be more aware and we can stop it within our own spheres.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Is that it's the idea of educating individuals on how to identify when that might be a possibility and how to verify or to correct it if you have it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't solve it on a global scale, but I can fix it here. I can educate more people. I mean, that's part of what we try to do with our podcast.
Yes.
Yes.
Over and over again.
Over and over and over again.
And you have to keep repeating it because people keep forgetting it.
Mm-hmm. Whee.
It's the old saw that if you want to memorize something, you have to repeat it 33 times.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's something I heard a long time ago.
Hmm. Does it work?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
I don't know. You repeat a whole lot of times, you tend to remember something.
That's true.
And if you do something a whole lot of times, you tend to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Vince Lombardi, for example, you know, the famous Green Bay Packers coach.
Yeah.
He always emphasized the basics in training.
Mm-hmm.
He said, hey, if you get the basics down, then you can do the other stuff.
That's cool.
That's why he worked on blocking and tackling and passing and running and the basics, because if you get those right and you have those down, then you can do the harder stuff.
Okay, but basic fact-checking is a basic here. I mean, problem-solving is a basic,
but
we're not
also
emphasizing it enough.
But it's also time-consuming.
Well, yeah, there's
and
that.
One of the things I was reading today, in fact, was that the human brain receives something like, they get like a million inputs a second, and they only can focus on 40 of them. Mm-hmm. We're overwhelmed with data being shoved at us and inputs that we have to prioritize. And so there's a lot of things that if it appears to be kind of reasonable, we let it pass. And that's the whole problem with the internet and human interactions, is that if it seems reasonable, the confidence man, the con man, they're reasonable. They're nice. Now, the classic thing that people say about con men is, but he was so nice.
Yes.
So if it seems reasonable, we let it pass. Mm-hmm. But, and that's why we have to rely on experts. But the trouble is, how do we know to trust experts? We don't. We have to take it on an act of faith that they know what they're talking about.
You can also do some degree of educating yourself. Like, I am not an immunologist.
No.
But I've spent, because I've been motivated, a significant amount of time studying immunology and allergies and how biology works so I can understand what is reasonable and scientifically backed and not. That's one of the areas I end up getting into, I don't want to say debates, but I get very frustrated with, particularly since I have family members who have severe allergies, is I get a lot of folks coming to me saying, don't you know allergies are caused by this or that or pesticide or whatever else they want to push it on? Or do you think vaccines caused your allergies? And no, because I have an understanding of how the immune system, how T cells and mast cells and immunoglobulins work and how your lymph nodes work, I know how allergies function, at least, and I know what we know and what we don't know. So I can look at these ridiculous blog posts people send me and go, no, actually, that's not. So I'm not an expert, but I can understand some of it, and it didn't take that long.
But you put in time.
Mm-hmm.
Understand? And that's one of the things. Malcolm Gladwell talks about, it takes like 10,000 hours of practice to become an expert on something. And I've heard that number bandied around by other people, that if you spend 10,000 hours on a subject, you'll be an expert on it. Yeah, that's quite possibly true. And I know that from my own personal experience. For example, I would consider myself an expert in physics, at least some areas of physics.
You have a PhD.
Well, and that represents, if you look at it, more than, well, let's see, the number of hours of physics are about probably 15 to 20,000 hours in my lifetime when I was really working on physics.
Right.
So, yes. But physics is such a broad area now that you can only say you're doing it part.
Right.
I have a hobby of woodworking, which I've been doing now for more than 20 years. I probably spent about 10,000 hours on that, and so I know a lot about woodworking.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's a lot of things I don't know a lot about. And so I had to take or learn who I can trust. And quite often, it's just based on the first few seconds of meeting somebody, whether you trust them or not.
Well, but see, that's the problem, though. I mean, take this back to Volkswagen. Part of being an expert on a process, on your company or anything else, is challenging your assumptions. I mean, I didn't just study immunology in a vacuum and read a bunch of books. I talked with other people, I listened to other arguments, I applied principles, and I discussed them with communities to determine what was really happening. Because there are some things I thought in the beginning that weren't accurate, and it's through the constant challenging and interaction we do that. I don't think you can determine if something is an expert in a vacuum. That, for instance, that's how con men function, is they earn your confidence, and you don't really check the background, the references, you don't look at the context. Or you look at Volkswagen, they had assumptions about what was happening, and no one bothered to, or at least they didn't challenge those assumptions to the degree that was necessary.
Well, actually, with Volkswagen, what really happened was that they gamed the test.
Yes, they did.
They knew that, hey, when you're testing, we could do this with the computer and make the results look like they were supposed to. But in actuality, when you're out on the road, it's, that's when you get your good gas mileage and everything else, it was something else entirely different. And it wasn't until someone tested it in the actual operating environment that they were caught.
But at that point, someone challenged the assumption. That's the whole point. Someone was motivated to do that for whatever reason.
But we also assumed, hey, you have the emissions test. It tells you whether your car is performing the way it should or not. Because I take my F-150 Ford truck into emissions test every 2 years, plug it into there, run it, and then they give me a sheet of paper saying, yep, you're okay.
Right.
How do I know it's really okay? I don't.
Well, it's also, we don't, most of us were not experts on the process of how emissions tests work and what the loopholes were.
Or you don't have the equipment.
Right.
So, and you don't have the time to learn. So it's all these things which go into it. So you end up with trust. And that is one of the biggest victims that you have with something like Volkswagen, or even before that, Enron, Arthur Anderson. Right. You have this trust that you've built up because they had a reputation. Volkswagen had a marvelous reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And in less than a week, it's totally trashed.
Right.
Now, the problem is, because they no longer have that trust, now you have a lot of people that are going to be damaged. There's the people who own Volkswagens. Are they getting, can they still drive them or can they not? Are they going to get them fixed or are they not? The dealers who now have cars mm-hmm. sitting on their lot that they can't sell because yep. no one wants to buy them.
Well, that's a huge breakdown of trust. I mean, they sold, it's fraud. They sold products
yes.
to companies to sell. And so they're franchisees. They're licensed dealers. That's a huge trust violation.
Very huge. And how do you recover from that? You may not.
Mm-mm.
Now, I don't think that, you know, the difference between Enron and Volkswagen is that there was other companies that could do what Enron was supposed to be doing, you know, dealing with energy trading and so on. But who replaces Volkswagen?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the problem we had back in the 70s and 80s with the big three auto dealers.
Right.
Especially Chrysler. You know, Chrysler was going to go out of business. But at the time, they were making the M1 tank.
Yeah.
So, you know, you really can't. And so they got government bailouts, you know, government guaranteed loans, basically,
mm-hmm.
to stay in business. And they were able to recover. But they didn't have the loss of trust that Volkswagen has.
Mm-hmm.
Enron lost the trust of the investors and everyone else. And
mm-hmm.
Arthur Anderson also was severely damaged by that. In fact, they were out of existence.
Mm-hmm.
But you had other auditing companies that could step in and fill the gap. The trouble is, Volkswagen is a big part of Germany.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes all the way back to the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. What?
And
I think also, though, what we're getting at here is there are really two aspects here. There's expertise and trust, which are two different things.
Yes.
And you also have to be very careful about what someone is an expert in, because if an organization has expertise and you can remove the people, you can rebuild the system so that there's trust by either reforming it, bringing in new people, changing how you interrogate mm-hmm. that your practices and your policies, you can rebuild the trust. There are organizations that have plenty of trust, but you realize their expertise isn't what you thought it is. I mean, I no offense to anyone who is interested in essential oils, but if I have one more person who walks up to me and tells me that essential oils being rubbed on my kid's foot will solve their allergies, I'm going to have to hit something. And many of them, I mean, have spent hours and hours studying this information, studying their field, what they're selling. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't call them an expert in what they are actually saying they're an expert in, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And now a lot of people very much trust them as well. So there is a balance here
mm-hmm.
between trust and expertise, but also understanding what that expertise really is in. Someone might be an expert in the materials that have been put out by the company they purchase their essential oils from. But that may not be the same thing as being an expert in essential oils, for instance, or in being an expert in immunology or physics or anything else. I mean, I've met a bunch of people who claim to be experts in physics who studied a specific kind of pseudophysics or metaphysics, right? And you,
yes.
we've run into these too. Like, what is it? We got an email. It was a newsletter a while ago from a coach out of Seattle who I'd met at a conference. She said something along like, physics tells us that blank. And it was something about vibrations and something else. But I remember sitting there and I brought it to you and you were like, no, that's nothing to do with physics. There's nothing to do with physics there. And these people would consider themselves experts on certain subjects.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, again, where community comes in. You can't be an expert when you are only taking information from one specific context or a source.
Mm-hmm.
I think real expertise and trust comes from your expertise being challenged, being proven over and over again by multiple sources and evolving.
Well, experts also know what the boundaries are.
Yes.
They know that, hey, my expertise goes to this far.
Mm-hmm.
I can't extend it beyond there because it doesn't apply.
Right.
Or we don't know if it applies.
Mm-hmm.
Or we don't know how it applies. They know the limits and they will generally self-limit themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because sticking your nose too far out means that, hey, you're going to destroy your credibility as an expert.
Right. You know, we ran into this a lot when I was financial counseling. There would be people who would come into to my office, because I was a financial counselor for the military mm-hmm. for 2 years. I had a fellowship from FINRA to do that. And I had been through, I mean, AFCPE's program. I had taken courses at Utah State in financial counseling from some of the best mm-hmm. people in the business. Real experts who've been doing this. There was data to back it up. And people would come into my office and tell me they'd been following Dave Ramsey or Susie Orman's system mm-hmm. or something else. And it hadn't worked for them. And they were so depressed because I'd heard so many people who this had worked for. And I'd have to sit them down and explain the background that mm-hmm. Dave Ramsey wasn't an expert in financial counseling. He was a business guy who came up with a system that he started selling people. He wasn't a financial counselor. It was one very rigid system that he was an expert in, sure. He was an expert in his system working for certain kinds of people. But I then explained to them how their life and their specific financial circumstances didn't fit that particular expertise that he had.
A classic example of that is Linus Pauling. He got a Nobel Prize in chemistry, mm-hmm. and he started pushing vitamin C as a great cure-all.
Right.
Again, he was an expert in he's an expert in chemistry, yes, mm-hmm. but not in how vitamin C can affect a lot of diseases or conditions.
Right.
And, you know, that's why you go to a medical doctor who will tell you whether or not you need to have all this vitamin C or not, or what happens if you take mega doses or whatever have
right.
you. Because, again, the physician is an expert on the human body. Mm-hmm. Linus Pauling was an expert on chemistry. Now, that doesn't mean that the outsiders can't have insights.
No, not at all. I mean,
in fact, quite often, that's a very useful place to have. But, again, it needs to be balanced.
And it needs to be reviewed by a community. It needs to be mm-hmm. exist in the world with challenge, not in a vacuum. Which is what I was able to explain to people. Like, the goal of financial counseling for me was not to know how to solve every single problem out there. It was to understand how to match people, recognize these are the differences in your circumstances, and here are the tools that might help you. It was to match people with tools. Whereas someone like Dave Ramsey, who has had great success, don't get me wrong, he has a very rigid system that works for people with a certain lifestyle and a certain set of needs. It is completely useless for people with other personality types, other challenges they're dealing with, other mental health issues. And so that's one of the other things to really look at when we're talking about expertise, is are we matching the right... Are we understanding what someone's expertise is in, really? And I tell people, I'm not a credit counselor. I'm a financial counselor. I can send you to a credit counselor. I can send you to, I'm not a financial planner. I don't give investment advice. Mm-hmm. But I can send you to someone and help you figure out what you need to do to get someone who has that expertise for you. And that was actually, I think that comes to really what the foundation of trust is, that you don't gain trust by just solving people's problems. You gain trust by understanding problems and then pointing people or helping people find the tools to make the situation better.
And helping them to understand what their situation really is.
And you look at Volkswagen, again, we keep coming back to this. I'm sure that whoever came up with this workaround for emissions testing, whoever gave that the go-ahead, I'm sure that they trusted that person or that team of people mm-hmm. to be experts in how to work around that problem.
Yes.
To exploit the loophole.
And someone very likely said they'll never mm-hmm. know about this.
Because they believed that this person understood the problem and had a fix for it. But now we're in a different position. People have to believe now. If you want to regain trust and mm-hmm. and maintain regain the community and the government and everyone else's trust mm-hmm. in Volkswagen, they're going to have to show that they can bring in people who understand the problem and can match everyone with the solutions to fix it.
And it's not just the problem of what their emissions are.
Oh, no,
it's
now
a system. It's a problem of how could you have a system that would allow that to happen? Mm-hmm. And how do you change the culture and the system mm-hmm. so it doesn't happen again?
Yes, that. Hi, everyone. It's Meredith. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, you can get more crisis management and prevention tips and strategies for free at our website, www.me2-solutions.com. That's www.me2-solutions.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for ME2 space solutions, and you should find our profile. You can also find me on Twitter under my handle, The Quality Girl. Thanks for listening.
Copyright 2013 by Hutchison Solutions, LLC. All rights reserved. But now, seriously, folks, no part of this podcast may be reproduced in whole or part without our permission. But we'll be happy to give it to you if you just fire us an email, which you can find on our website. Thank you.